Good evening and welcome to this Wednesday webcast with me, Scott Cassin-Rennie, himself,
Al Coates,
and our lovely guest this evening is Helen Bonnick. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to introduce you there, but, you know, it just happened.
There was a pause. I didn't know. I was hanging, Scott. I was hanging.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that. Yeah, yeah. So this has started the way it means to go on, clearly.
Yeah, quality.
So welcome, quality. Welcome, Helen. It's been a long time since we've spoken to you on a podcasty thing, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Quite a few years, actually. Yeah. So it's nice to have you back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Good.
Yeah, what have you been doing, Helen? Introduce yourself. Okay. For people who don't know who you are, introduce who you are and how what you've been up to last year or so.
So I'm a social worker by background, but I haven't worked with families for a long time. I moved into practice education and then I escaped into this strange world of child parent violence and abuse about it's a horrible length of time ago now because I can't remember. I'm going to say 12 years ago. No, 15 years ago, but mostly since 2011. And I spend my time running a website, which is Holes in the Wall, and writing and speaking, I was doing training events, consultancy, all sorts of things like that, generally trying to raise awareness and improve provision and try and help people, really. So in the last year, I have slowed down significantly. I've dyed my hair purple, as you can see. just generally
I've
trying.
Noticed. Sorry. If you were trying to make a statement, and Al's colorblind, so he wouldn't have known anyway. So.
No one can remember what they've done in the last 2 years, can they?
Yeah, true.
No. Were they? I don't know. So, but yeah, the work, interestingly, at the beginning of the last 2 years, I thought I was going to slow down really significantly and actually work's taken off. So, but I'm not doing so many of these events, but a bit more of trying to concentrate a bit more on my website. That's the word. Yeah.
So can I ask then, what got you into the CPVA kind of
Don't
start work?
That.
I
what? You start with a really that? Contentious. I don't know.
No, I'm asking a general question about why Helen got into it. I think that's a very suitable question.
Very polite and respectful, Scott. Very polite
Thank
and
you.
Respectful.
Well, yeah. I'm trying, you know.
Okay.
Unlike my course, whatever.
So I had the opportunity to do a master's in 2004, and decided to spend some time looking at how easy it was for parents to get help if their children were being abusive towards them. And it was something I'd come across at work quite a lot over the years since 1989, somewhere around there, 1990 something, I was coming across it for work. And then when I moved into working in schools, I was finding quite a lot there. And realizing that it was no one really was talking about it. No one knew what was going on. So then I decided to see how easy it was to get help found. In 2004, 2006, there was very little help and also very little research. So whereas if you try and start researching, or you're interested in reading about child abuse, let's say, or intimate partner violence, there's masses and masses of work right across the world. But at that time, when I was looking in 2005, let's say, there was almost nothing. And it was where people had it in, it was very mixed. It was coming up with lots of mixed stories. But then what was interesting was about 2010, people started really started writing about it and coming across things in research into other things. So within the adoption field, Julie Selwyn put out her really groundbreaking report into adoption breakdown or disruption.
Yeah.
And kind of around the same time, lots of other people were tripping over it in work and where they were looking at maybe problems with antisocial behaviour and housing or with the youth justice system. Lots of different fields, and everybody was tripping over it simultaneously and started talking about it. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, if you like. And so I started connecting with lots of people, and things just took off. So my website took off as and is now a knowledge hub, if you like, a resource hub. And I have on there things to do. Well, you can go on there for events and training listing, but also I blog on the front page stuff that is happening, or for ideas that are just around, things that people are talking about, listings of research directory page if people wanting to find help local to them. There's a page where this will go up on there's a page called Sound and Vision, where I have links to podcasts, television interviews, radio stuff, so that people can use that if they wanted to do training, if they want to use a clip, or if they just want to listen and get some more, if they want to do some training, maybe quietly on their own, if you like, that can be useful for that. And there's more and more films and books as well that are touching on it as part of a kind of dramatization. So that's been interesting to watch as it's happened. And the last thing, the most recent page I've put up is a page where, because practitioners were coming to me and saying, I'm working in this field, but I feel really isolated and I don't know where to get help. Because my own supervisor at work really doesn't know anything about what's going on. So there's a page there where practitioners can go to for consultancy. So different organisations that are offering either kind of one-off advice sessions or will offer you clinical supervision. So, yeah, so that keeps me quite busy, actually. And that could be a full-time job in itself, but I don't let it be.
I mean, it's a really interesting phenomenon. And obviously, you've tracked the journey from sort of like, you know, going back to the 80s. Yeah. You've tracked this, the progress of this. I mean, in some ways, I don't think the phenomenon has necessarily got more or less, but I think it's just, it's become more apparent or more visible. So I kind of first bumped into you, I think probably 2014, 15, 16. And you kind of, I can't even remember how we met. But what I'd be interested to know is, I think that since then, I think there's been an exponential growth in terms of understanding, but also the support that's available. But can I bring you back to the very start, really, which is the thorny issue of how we actually define this? Because if you want to start a fight on Twitter, I'm your man.
Clearly.
So we've got, I mean, please add in any definitions I can't think of. So we've got child to parent violence, right? We've got child adolescent to parent, APVA, so adolescent to parent violence and aggression. We've got CP. What else have we got?
How many do you want? I can give you 30 or 40 probably, but not off the top of my head.
Oh my goodness.
and different phraseology is used in different parts of the world. So I you're talking about definition. I'm probably going to call it a name rather than a definition, because the definition issue is even more complicated.
Right.
So what is included and what's not included. Yeah. And whether, but in terms of a name, that's been a contentious issue since I've been involved in the field. And certainly, I mean, in the 80s, there wasn't a name. There wasn't a name that I was coming across. One of the earliest things people were talking about was battered parents, because that was what they were, the researchers were recognizing was happening. But when I first started getting into it in terms of study myself, people were using the phrase parent abuse because, again, like battered parents, that was what they could see was happening in people. And they were using abuse in the broadest sense, I suppose. But that was problematic, although some people are still using that, and it depends where you live in the world. Some people are still using that, but I found that really problematic, because whenever I talked to people, they would assume that I meant, because it was so out of their experience, if I said parents abuse, the assumption was parents abusing their children. Just that was the assumption that people made, because they couldn't think any other direction. So I stopped using that and started using the phrase child to parent violence. And I settled on that because I was using child to include, this is interesting in itself. At the time, I was thinking of you're a child as in terms of the relationship, but I was still thinking about in terms of up to 18 or 25, probably. Child, and it had two in it, so you could see the direction and you could see who it was towards. It was towards the parent or carer or caregiver or person in the parenting role. But I was still using violence, and I think that came about really because I was part. I was saying to you earlier that way back at 2013-14, I was in a meeting, and people were trying to talk then about what did they want to call it? Was it child to parent violence? Was it child to parent abuse? And some people were saying, absolutely, is child to parent abuse. It feels like the abuse that people are getting from partners. So that's what we want to call it. And other people would say, I don't recognize it in that way. I don't recognize it as abusive behavior, but I want to call it child parent violence. And people were saying, but it's not all violence. And other people were saying, but even if it's not actually physically violent, the abuse feels violent. And we were just going round and round and round. And people didn't agree, but I think I settled on child to parent violence because probably because it had came off the tongue more easily, perhaps. Maybe that was, you know, even at that level, it rolled off your tongue easy. But some people, you know, they've gone in parallel in this country. And then, you know, you've got people using saying child on parent rather than child to parent. There's so many different variations, even in this country. And then
we did a poll on Twitter. We asked people, do definitions matter? And it wasn't, we didn't have a huge number of people, about 60 people came back. 80% said, yeah, definitions do matter. But it was interesting, some of the people who said definitions don't matter, and they said, I just want someone to acknowledge actually that this is difficult for both of us. But I think reflecting on the importance of definitions for me, one of the things that stuck in my head was that when I did, the child parent violence and aggression survey, whatever, 2017-18, and families would come back to me and say, I won't do your survey. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, well, why not? And they said, well, because I don't like your definition. And we were using a specific definition that talks about abuse or intent. Yeah. And they said, oh, I can't do that because as much as I don't like my four-year-old's behavior, I can't. Mm-hmm. Buy into the idea that this is intentional, premeditated abuse. Yeah. So is that a problem? Do you think we're going to get to the bottom of that, or are we just going to have to dance around it?
It's complicated. I think that discussion will always be there. I think there will always be, whatever name we choose, there will never be a name that, unless you have a whole sentence, there's never going to be a name that's satisfied or everybody feels comfortable. Because what we've learned over the last X years is that almost every single situation is different. How parents experience the behavior, the challenging behavior, whatever you want to call it, is different because the circumstances and families are unique. They have, and there are so many different factors that might lead into how this might come about. For some families and not for others, perhaps. And so whatever we choose, I guess there's always going to be someone that feels it doesn't explain their situation. I think it also begs the question about whether it's possible to put all of them into one field. And I mean, many people perhaps listening will be familiar with Yvonne Newbold, who's done so much work with children who have learning difficulties, disabilities. And often quite severe, and whose behaviour comes from a different place, perhaps. And she's using the term violent and challenging behaviour because she feels that best describes what those families will be experiencing. But so she's using violent behaviour as a descriptor. But then other people will be saying, so, you know, do we then also distinguish families where there is adoption as a really major issue in how this has come about? Is there a separate group of families where there's a domestic abuse issues, and are separate group of families where the parents have mental health problems perhaps, or are using drugs or alcohol, a separate group where there is neurodiversity issues? And in the end you get so many different groups, and the other problem is that many of those will be overlapping. So you might have a child that's experienced two or three of those different factors, and where are we going to put them? Or parents that are straddling different camps, where are we going to put them? And what different definitions are we use? What I think in the in Australia, they talk about they're talking about adolescence particularly, but they're saying adolescent violence in the home. So again, they're using violence, but it's kind of saying it's going on in the home, acknowledging where it's happening, and also saying we may not be seeing it elsewhere. And I think that's really crucial for a lot of families. It's so confined into the home. In other families, it's not. So they're excluding a lot of people, but some people feel much more comfortable using that sort of title. So, I mean, Al, you did some work with Wendy, didn't you? And you came up with quite a long name at that point, which some people may find helpful. And my own personal feeling is that we need to have something short and snappy, but it needs to be generally agreed, because if we're all using different terminology, the problem is that you go and ask for help and someone says, you what?
I think I've got a few issues. There's a few sort of parts when it's the word abuse, I just can't countenance. I don't know about you, Scott, but when you talk about child to parent abuse, it doesn't, if you're talking about maybe an 18-year-old assaulting a parent or carer or whoever in the home, then that's one thing. But when you're talking, you know, I guess, I don't know about you, Scott, but I know a lot of people who've experienced really difficult behaviour from children from tiny. How can you call a 7-year-old an abuser? It just doesn't, and that may be me being a, you know, a corduroy wearing man bag slinging social worker, which I do around the house.
You know, on a Saturday.
just around the house. Or it may be just a reaction to the whole notion of abuse and the issue of power dynamics and, you know, the abuser having power over the abused and all of that stuff. But also the word adolescent, I really struggle when that's in the phraseology, because I think that then it reframes it back. It sort of feels like a retrograde step, because I think probably you and I, Scott, have worked really hard to kind of go, this is, there's a lot of people under 10 who are really struggling, or parents of children or carers.
It's an interesting one, because, I mean, I would be in the camp personally, from a personal perspective, I'd be in the 20% camp, because if I was to describe it, I would still describe it as CPV. And it wasn't until the kind of issue of the definition of it was brought up that I went, I can see why some would not like it, you know, why some people would want to name it something else. But I think for me, the definition is quite, you know, it was what we were going through at that point in time, because it was physical violence. So from my own personal perspective, that's where kind of I'm still at on it. But there's other things that are thrown into the mix of this almost like a spectrum of violence and abuse, if you like. I'm not downplaying it. I'm not making fun of it. I'm just saying that there's quite a big spectrum here, because if we look at domestic abuse, you know, it doesn't have to be physical. It could be mental. It could be, you know, all these sorts of things. And I think that translates for me into some of the behaviours that potentially we see.
He's paused. So
it's a very tricky one in terms of language, but. Have I gone off?
You have.
No, you've come back. You did briefly, but you've come back, Scott. Don't keep talking, because we can hear you. This is hilarious.
This is my headphones. I don't know what's happened to them. They've gone off.
All right, don't worry.
My apologies.
Just keep going. You were.
I was ranting on, wasn't I? Again.
Well, you did freeze. No,
I think it was a valid.
You kept talking, but you did freeze. It was quite interesting to watch.
Oh. Without my lips moving, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So I don't know where I ended there before I kind of thinged off. These have gone. Excuse me. But I understand why some people do have kind of issues with it, but you know, I think
we have to acknowledge that the behaviour that we're talking about does cover a wide spectrum, doesn't it? And for some people, it will be perhaps verbal jibes, quite, you know, really nasty stuff, hateful stuff, sexual stuff, perhaps even. And if
financial, even, you know,
But for some people, well, just talking about the language, for other people, it will be lots of, it will be physical stuff. And whether that's punching or you know, lashing out, kicking, biting, maybe, you know, using weapons, perhaps hurling. I mean, and do we include hurling furniture across the room in that?
Yeah, I think so.
For other people, it's going to be psychological. So just really nasty, undermining, isolating, humiliating. And then the financial stuff that you're talking about, Scott, as well. So there will be families where that's perhaps even the main focus of what's going on, that there's money going missing, or that they're being asked to, they're being required to pay debts because of threats, or they're having to fork out masses and masses of money because of damage to property, or there'll be other families where the behaviour feels very much like coercive control generally, and families are, and parents are finding that they have no authority within that home because it's just been, they've been isolated and made to be insignificant in that situation. So what we're talking about covers such a wide range of things. And so I think that also explains why it's so difficult to find one simple phrase, you know, three letters or whatever to cover all of that.
Yeah.
Whether we then, I mean, whether we then say child to parent violence and abuse, and we hope that covers it. And when interestingly, when I was writing my book and the publisher said, you've got to say violence and abuse, you can't just say violence. Because of this very question, what are we going to call it? Some people won't like that. Some people won't like that. So we'll call it both.
Right.
So I've kind of got used to that now.
Yeah.
It doesn't run off the tongue so easily, but you can get used to it after a while. And maybe that satisfies people because they feel there's something that they can recognize in there. I mean, I'm speaking only from my own point of view. I'm very privileged that I haven't lived through this. Mm. So I can't speak for people who every day are facing this sort of challenging behavior and need to have some sense of making sense of it. And that's why we use words to make sense of things, don't we? And so you need to have a set of words that feel appropriate for you as well.
Yeah. And I think if you identify with a specific, you know, thing, for me, it's about the early days of that. You know, I've heard of CPV when probably 18 months after we started experiencing it. So therefore I relate CPV to that release of knowing that there was something, it was called something. There wasn't,
it wasn't just you experiencing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that is a key part of it. So I think that's why I'm less inclined to go, we need to change the name. You know, it would be nice to have something that covered everybody's experience, but you know, that's just one of those things, isn't it? It's one of those very difficult things to cover. So, yeah. Hmm.
That's a conversation we could, if we were sat in a pub and we would go round and round, we could have that conversation all night, couldn't we?
Five o'clock in the morning, being kicked out of the pub, yeah.
Yeah, again.
Again.
I'm not going to make it till that late, guys. I've got a good
schedule
then.
Yeah.
Nor would we, I don't think.
Then, no. Thinking about the landscape then, I've seen the rise of an awful lot of more organisations that are supporting specific communities, but the issue, the fundamental issue of this kind of challenging, violent, aggressive behaviour within children. So how would you describe the interventions that we've got now? Are we in a better place? Are we in a transition place to somewhere better? Or, you know, what's the landscape like now?
It's
a big question.
Yeah, it's a big question. At the moment, I would say it's expanding. Very early on, there was a small number of interventions. When I first, back in 2013, I first said, I haven't got enough to do. I'll do a mapping project. And that was also because I'd got lots of stuff in my head and people were saying, we need this written down. You can't be allowed to just hold things in your head. We need you to write them down. And I could have probably reeled off 20 or 30 agencies in the country that I knew were working with families. When I came to do the project, I think I got it up to 40. And I knew there were others, but I didn't know. But there was lots of, some people were not wanting to be involved in the project for all, or I was going into their spam folder, or they hadn't got time to fill in the all the reasons that people don't answer questionnaires. And then there was a little bit, there was a bit of growth after that. And then people started losing funding. So what was really tragic at that point was that the programs that had been well established started to close. But at the same time, other stuff was opening. So there was a period of kind of when it, I would say it sort of plateaued. There was movement coming and going. And then what we've got at the moment now is a lot of growth. And that's for a mixture of reasons. And I would say one of those is that a lot more people have been on awareness training and have thought, oh, boy, we need to do something in my authority, in my team. And sometimes that's involved buying in a program, and sometimes it's involved. And there are programs where you can go on facilitator training and deliver a specific model or just a specific program. But other people were saying, I've done a bit of this training, a bit of that training, I can write a program. I know, I've got a sense, knowing I know the community that I work in, I know what people are like, I know what the issues are, I can design a program. So there was a bit of that going on. And there's now, there's been a burst of home office money recently as a result of all the stuff that's going on in lockdown and the massive awareness of the problems of domestic abuse within lockdown. And so there is currently a lot more work going on and being commissioned generally, I would say, through domestic abuse agencies. So they are broadening their offer to include work with young people as well. So right at the beginning of that, Al, you asked me what sorts of programs there are.
Yeah.
So there are some specific programs that you can buy in. You know, if this is something which interests you, I refer you to the recent literature review, which Vicky Baker and I did for the Home Office, which lists a lot of the programs and talks about the different components and is an interesting read in itself. That was a rapid literature review because there was a sense that we need to see what's going on in the country or how effective it is and where the gaps are. But in terms of the sorts of programs are, there's a group of programs. There's a group program called Who's in Charge, which works just with parents and is a kind of 8-week, 9-week program, which is very much about empowering parents to feel able to understand what's going on, to understand the relationship better and to look at ways of communicating and changing what's going on within the home. And I would say that that's programs been going for a long time, and people generally say that it's useful, but perhaps earlier on in the situation. There's a group, a whole series of programs that offer what we call parallel work. So they would work with the young person and with the parents. And when I use those terms, I hope people will understand what I'm saying. So parents, carers, adoptive, foster families, whatever. And there's a sense that we're looking at a relationship here, and it's important to look at the relationship as well as what's going on for individuals. And they will do some stuff together, and then they'll do separate work, and they'll come together and go off. And so there's this sort of sense going on, and a lot of that would be about understanding what the issues are within communication and how that communication can be you could say resolved, but developed and improved and made more healthy and more safe. So all of these programs will be looking at safety work, helping people, you know, as an essential. That's the first kind of foundation, if you like. We've got to make sure families are safe. But then looking at what's going on for the young person, why are they experiencing what they are, looking at anger, looking at responsibility, looking at what are the gains? You know, if you're using this behavior, what are the gains for you in this? How can we help you to look at that in a different way? And then looking at improving, finding different ways to communicate. Then there's programs like nonviolent resistance, where, again, you're working often just with the, not exclusively, but often just with the parents to understand, again, this is a relational problem. Al, you've done the training on this, so are you going to tell me, and you're going to knock me down in a minute, but my understanding is this is very much saying, I can only change myself. You know, this is this is a relationship issue. I can't change what you're doing, but I can, if I change what I'm doing, I can kind of cut into that circle, if you like, that we're not reinforcing our behavior all the time. We can find a different way. I can choose to not intervene on some things. I can decide what the priorities are. What's worth having? What do I feel is really important in here, and what things can be left to go for now?
That's really interesting, because I think that I met you last week. We had a a nice evening out together, didn't we? I'm not sure I can sort of how I did describe it like that. Anyway,
was it work or was it a party? Just
it was definitely work. There was no
right, cake. Okay.
There was no cake.
Yeah.
And there was
I brought a fax machine just to make sure to clarify that it was a work event.
There was definitely peer reflection going on.
A lot of peer reflection. And I think that the I'm thinking about like 5 years ago, my work was really about trying to help people make sense of their children, trying to, you know, a lot of it was de-escalation, which is all part of NVR. But I think, and probably you as well, Scott, what I've seen increase more and more is that the thing you can really influence is the adult in the room. Mm-hmm. And you've got to support them. You've got to kind of love them, because they're often feeling very unloved, and very, their whole world has been, their whole norm and their sense of who they are and all of that has all been totally shifted. And like you say, I think that that is where I've moved towards, and that is NVR for me, but that's just because I've been on the course and, you know, but as you do, I've got the t-shirt and all of that kind of thing. But that seems to be realistic, that it's actually... I don't know about you, Scott. Have you had people come and work directly with you as a family around this issue?
We've had kind of drips and drabs up until the point where we left the UK, because it's not really, I mean, it's here in Ireland, but it's not widely recognised, because it's a different environment that we've got here. You know, there's still kind of a way to go in terms of understanding of, you know,
it's why. It's interesting you say that, because... And I'm intrigued that you're living in Ireland and you're saying that in a sense, because one of the people very early on that was involved in work is Declan Coogan, who's based at Galway. And he's very much developed NVR within Ireland and doing training on that in Ireland.
Yeah, it's an interesting country to be a part of, because there's a number of conditions that we would recognise in the UK that aren't recognised here. It's a very, you know, I mean, Galway is literally 20 minutes up the road from me. I'm not far away from that at all. And like I say, it is here. But the kind of the overall theme about the country is, I have to kind of be wary of how I say this, because it might sound like I'm criticizing, because I'm not. But the agencies that deal with some of the kind of stuff on behalf of the government and the country are kind of specific to one or two things. So for them to see beyond, you know, so, you know, child and parent violence, FASD would be another example of that. You know, some agencies are really, really hot on it. Some aren't. And of course, the systems are different. You know, adoption here is a very different kettle of fish, you know, in terms of children who are adopted, you know, mainly from overseas nowadays, from in Ireland, whereas years ago, it would have been very much domestic adoption, but it would have been the kind of mother and baby homes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's changed and it's changing. And I think that there's a lot of awareness driving awareness to be done within that. And there's, you know, there's some great practitioners here, some amazing people, some amazing psychologists, that I think for adoption and fostering, so it's a very kind of small part of that compared to the UK. So I think that's, you know, the difference. And of course, I'm not involved in the biological family kind of side of things over here. So that kind of could look very different to it could look for us, you know, because we are quite a small minority in the country in terms of adoptive parents. You know, when we met with an agency a couple of years ago, they told us they'd done 3 adoptions in the whole county in the last 5 years. Well, that's a tight, you know, if you think about, if somebody said that to you in England, we did 3 adoptions in the last 5 years in our county, you would say, what are you playing at, man? You know, you should be doing like, I don't know, a couple of hundred or whatever. So it is very different. So I think in that respect, you know, things like NVR and, you know, like I say, various conditions are still relatively unknown. It's not that they're not trusted, but there's, you know, they want to see the kind of end results over a very long period of time in terms of how they work. So, and I'm sure there's, you know, there'll be Irish people who say, no, that's not how it is. But, you know, from our perspective, that's how it looks as outsiders looking in. So, you know, and of course, there's no adoption support fund. There's, you know, it's very different in terms of accessing that kind of support as well. Although there are amazing people here, I have to say. And I'm not saying that just because I seem to have slagged them off, but, you know, it is very different. It is very different. You know, there is NVR training. You can be trained to, you know, do the NVR stuff. excuse me. But if I see it, not seen that here before, or I've not seen that for a while. So it's not discussed. It's not, you know, openly discussed as it might be in the UK nowadays. So, and I think that's the key thing. There's a lot of things that are kind of just bubbling away and need kind of exposure, if that makes sense.
I feel as if I did NVR a bit of a disservice, and I need to kind of, I feel I need or want to jump in.
You don't need to.
I love NVR.
I find NVR very compelling at lots of levels, but I haven't done the training as Al's done. And I think a lot of programs are using elements of NVR. I think a number of people now have done the training and are, if they're not delivering it as a pure version, if you like, a number of people are finding that there are elements of the work that have a lot of appeal. And things like the recognition of the need to actually speak it and say, this is what's happening and it's not going to happen anymore. Hmm. And in that sense, we're back to giving it a name, aren't we? Or speaking it out and saying, but also the need for support for parents and recognizing, yeah, you said that so many parents, once this starts happening, you find yourself very, very isolated. And that if you're very, very isolated, it becomes harder and harder, and it just goes down and down, or round and round, or however you want to think about it. But how you break out of that NVR would be looking to identify people that can support you. And so within many of the other programs that are going on, there's a recognition, I've got a cup of tea coming. How good is that? Thank you.
Excellent.
Anybody else? Milk, sugar?
yeah, count me in.
So yeah, look, the recognizing the need to, you can't do this on your own. You've got to have people that you can phone up and scream at or cry on, and
yeah,
people who'll back you up and say, you know, keep going, it's good, and we'll talk to your child or your young person as well. So you can't do it on your own. You've got to have people around you. So there's NVR definitely recognize that as well.
Yeah. So I mean, it's nothing new under the sun, is there? I mean, some aspects of NVR you could say, well, that's pace, you know, it's like, you know, strike de-escalation, which is, so, you know, is everywhere. You can de-escalation from any,
I think I find the whole thing about de-escalation really fascinating. There's so much about us as individuals, as human beings, that need to be right, isn't there? And it's very, very hard to let go of that, especially if you're absolutely convinced that you are right, even if, but I am right. But it is such, that whole de-escalation thing of being prepared to not be right just at the moment. We find it so hard, don't we? And it's a real challenge, I think, for all of us. In, you know, whether you're having a row with somebody or whether you're watching something, you know, there are many situations in everybody's life where really we ought to bring the temperature down rather, or think about how we're going to resolve this, discuss this, rather than ramping it up all the time. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm conscious of the time, so I've got one more question, and we're going to do a few more podcasts. Oh, have you?
Yeah.
That's exciting, Scott. Well done.
Rude.
My question is, thank you. So we've talked about specialist service, but do you think that across the general workforce, when I suppose I mean social care, so children and families, police, health, CAMHS, you know, someone texted, messaged me today saying, you know, we went to CAMHS and CAMHS were like, And I've had a, I think I probably told my story of the psychiatrist laughing when we told him, that my daughter had punched my wife in the face, and he laughed. That's another feeling. I'm having a feeling there. Do you think that the general workforce has a better understanding of what's going on than, say, 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
I'm going to say yes, because there's loads of people been putting out training courses, so you'd hope so. And, you know, even on Twitter today, I was seeing people were saying, looking forward to a really great day. We're going to be talking to teachers and social workers and people within medical services. So people are being exposed to it right across the board. I've had conversations with police wanting to set up awareness training sessions, webinars within different forces. I know there are Respect have a course that they've developed specifically to raise awareness within the police. So there is growing awareness. I know of social work degree courses where it gets a mention. Wow. Al, you've talked to social workers through BASWA. I'm at the end of the month, I'm doing a webinar for social work students. So incrementally, yes, awareness is increasing, and that has to be a good thing. But when you look at the size of the workforce and you look at the size of the amount of work that's going on, it's going to take us a long time to reach everybody. But we have to be pleased, you know, if you're a family that are in a place where the workforce hasn't been trained, then it's desperate. But at the same time, we hold in balance the knowledge that there are really good social workers, really good school workers, really good CAMHS workers. You know, CAMHS, there's the team in Greenwich were amongst the first in the country to offer any sort of service. So it is still so much where you live and luck of the draw. And that's tragic. And one of the things about lockdown was that with more online service, some of those services were offered up to anybody in the country. And so it became potentially easier to access help. It might have been a one-off conversation that you could have, but at least you could speak to someone and you could have that affirmation that what you were saying was real and that you weren't the only person, and someone to listen to you and believe you and respect what you were saying. So in that sense, the situation is much improved, yes, but it's still going to take a long time. We've got a long way still to go.
Yeah, thank you.
So my last question really, Helen, is about the reflections of the time that you've worked kind of in this field, arena, I don't know. And so I guess I'm just wondering if you've had any kind of reflections from young people who were the kind of, what's the word I need to say? I just need to watch my words here. Who were potentially violent or aggressive or abusive towards their parents? Is there anybody who's kind of come through that and is now kind of older, able to reflect on it, understand it? Or is that not something that kind of you're looking at or anybody's looking at in terms of where they're at now and you know?
I'm interested that you look at it, you're saying it in that way. And I think I have come across people who are now, as adults, my peers, really old adults, are saying, many years ago, I was invited onto the Victoria Derbyshire show. And one of the other people that was on the show talked about her own. What was interesting about that programme, that show, that edition, was that we knew some of the questions, but it was unscripted. And so people started talking about things that were, okay, so it's going that way now. Mm. And so she opened up about how she'd been abusive when she was a young person. So yes, there are people that are talking about this, but very few and far between. And, you know, it's one of those things, like the fact that I can name one is, that's it, you know, that's kind of it. When people have been doing research, it's been very, very difficult to gain, I'm going to say, to get ethical approval to speak to young people.
Yeah.
And that is a real issue. But also, even when people have gained ethical approval, often they've found that it's still difficult. Mm-hmm. But the practicalities of working. Either parents have been very effective gatekeepers for all sorts of really good reasons.
Right.
Or the young people have not felt inclined to offer themselves for work.
Yeah.
With two sorts of exceptions, I suppose. One is a lot of the programs. One of the first programs in Britain, again, was called Break for Change in Brighton, and they spent a lot of time filming what was going on for as part of the therapeutic process, but also capturing the voices of the young people, particularly in terms of what they thought was what was going on for them when they were doing this, and how they now felt, how their relationships within the family had improved, how they saw their future. So there is a body of work there. And there's also a body of work. So the person I mentioned earlier that I undertook the literary review with recently, Vicky Baker, Dr. Vicky Baker, her PhD was specifically the voices of young people. And so we've got that work as well.
Yeah.
So that's young people now still. So we haven't got that reflective back on from older people now saying, when I was a young lad, when I was in Gull, this is what I was doing.
Yeah.
But we have got those voices. And it's quite interesting to read her PhD because it is looking at, well, why, what was going on for you? What were the challenges for you? What did you think you were achieving? What was going on? Why was this happening essentially? And what will help you? So there is a small body of work that has looked at that, but it's minute and it's and so at some level, you know, we make claims about what it's like to be a young person in this situation, and we make lots of assumptions about what's going on, and they're based on, I suppose, an understanding of young people's lives generally, an understanding of how people grow, how they mature, how they get involved in all sorts of things outside the home. So I think it's a fascinating question, and I think it's something that we would like very much to develop further.
Mm. Yeah, and it reflects the complexity of the underlying risks and causes, doesn't it? That there's it's not this binary issue. And that's the kind of the dawning revelation, is that there could be 1,000 different types of intervention and they all probably would work with the right circumstance.
Yeah.
And for some young people, you know, what they're experiencing somewhere, whether, you know, potentially outside the home, is so hideous. And that's what, you know, for them, they're experiencing hideous, and they're trying to explain and just desperately, they're in despair, they don't know how to get help. You know, for other young people, that it is a very deliberate, you know, I intend to, you know, we're back onto intent, but I see a potential gain through doing this. I'm jolly well going to do this. So we're back to how do we include all those young people within this, within a simple name or simple definition, aren't we?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I often come back to the basics of social work, which is being a good listener.
I'm being curious.
Digging around, sniffing around. Well, that's it, you know, finding out what's really going on in people's heads. And I think that's, you know, some of the best conversations I've had are when you get to the bottom of it. And sometimes it's about parents who, there's these hidden anxieties that are driving behavior that are then stressing children. And, you know, you find these it's all very murky. It's all very murky. Anyway, it's 10 to 9.
I know, this has been a long one. I like the long ones because Al likes to be tucked up in bed by 9, but there's no chance of that happening tonight, you see. So I love to keep him up late when we're doing stuff like this. Hilarious.
Bless your heart. So Helen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing, and you know, and thank you for whoever brought you tea. Just some random man in your house bringing you tea. And we really look forward, and we'll put obviously you've got the Holes in the Wall website. We'll make sure people get to that, because I think that's an immeasurably helpful resource.
I have to say I have to say, if it wasn't for the Holes in the Wall website, I'm not sure where we would be. And you know, then similar to Al, Helen, known you since about 2015, 2016, kind of chatted to you, etc. And I genuinely don't know where we would have been. And I'm very grateful that, you know, the physical stuff is no longer for us. And I don't think that would have happened had we not had access to that kind of resource. So, you know, definitely if anybody is listening and they think, oh, that's me, then go to Holes in the Wall, because, yeah.
Can I put my last plug in for it as well then? Because what I always say is that it's not my website. I mean, I've been saying my website, but what I usually say is that it's our website as a community, whether that's a community of academics or practitioners or parents, to be used, but also to contribute to. That might be sending, you know, interesting things to read or to listen to. But if people want to write for it as well, I always welcome requests, and I'll consider... I won't necessarily publish everything that people send me. I consider publishing.
Why?
So yeah, people have a look at it, and hopefully there will be something that's helpful.
Yeah,
that's great. Thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you very much. It's been great to join you. Thank you.